Welcome back, my friends. I'm Dave Champion. This is my co-host, Bill Carnes. And together, we are totally unprepared. So, Bill, I understand that in this first segment, you want to tackle some state law issues.
State politics, yes.
Fire them up.
A couple of ugly things. Just to lay a little groundwork here, each state is run by one of two sets of rules, and there's a little bit of crossover if you look it up, but it's either Dillon rules or home rules. And I'll give you just an idea of these, and this is a very abbreviated version.
Excuse me.
Dillon rules essentially say that the state government sets the rules that lower governments in the state can operate by, counties, cities, other municipalities, townships. And it says what they're allowed to do.
Establishes boundaries.
Establishes their boundaries.
Okay.
Home rule is the exact opposite, meaning that the state legislature and the governor would sign legislation that says what they can't do. Everything else, sky's the limit.
Okay.
Okay. So Dillon rules, which is more restrictive, home rules, wide open.
Okay.
So there's some dangers in home rules.
So let me see if I can home rule. There are a couple of little boundaries in the sense of don't do.
Right.
But if that don't do hasn't been established, it's virtually boundaryless.
Sure. Like we are talking at lunch, the court case in Denver.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. This goes back to, I think, perhaps the mid of the late 90s. The city of Denver, they had a law which basically just eradicated the right to keep and bear arms if you were within the city of Denver. And somebody had been arrested, and their defense was that they have the right to keep and bear arms. And the judge would not permit that defense to be entered into the trial. And he castigated counsel, claiming that because Denver is a home rule city, the right to keep and bear arms was not a correct argument to make in defense of carrying a gun.
Yeah, so what he was saying then is essentially the city council in that particular instance was basically lord of all unless the state legislature said, you can't do this.
Yes. And that illustrates how boundaryless home rule is in that the judge felt that home rule authorized eradicating individual rights.
Yeah, it's very, very dangerous.
Yes.
It's very dangerous because then if you have, say, a 5 or 3 or 7 panel county commission in a rural county like there are in Nevada, that 3-person commission could get together, decide that this is the sort of law we're going to put into this county, and that's just the way it is. The thing is, Nevada is a Dillon rule state, and there are no exceptions. Senate Bill 29, or as it's labeled, SB 29, passed the Senate from the here in Nevada unanimously, 21-0, to change Nevada from Dillon rule to home rule. Very dangerous. It's sitting currently in the Assembly Government Affairs Committee. It's got to go through that committee to have a hearing, and then they would decide whether or not they want to have a vote. If they vote and they allow it out of committee, it then would go to the Speaker of the Assembly. He would decide whether or not to hold a vote on it. If the Assembly held a vote and they passed it, go to the governor's desk for a potential signature. Now, let me give you a little background on this.
Okay.
There's a group of people who've been lobbying for this to happen for the last 3 legislative sessions, and it keeps getting shot down.
And
somehow.
Tell me why, Bill.
Well, because what they want to do, and this is one of the leaders of this group, is the former governor of Nevada from back in the late 70s, Bob List, who is a registered Republican. He served as a Republican, but I got to tell you, I don't know Bob List, but I've seen his politics in the last few years, and they're horrible. They are left as can be. I think the guy's politics are scuzzy. Now, he might be a decent enough guy, but I got to tell you, his politics and what he's been trying to push through, I don't agree with at all. Not a thing yet.
You think it's injurious for the state of Nevada and for the citizens of Nevada?
I absolutely do.
All right.
Really, what we're talking about here is the ability of the smaller local governments and county governments to enter into public-private partnerships, which for the most part really stink. Because as it usually works out, Dave, as you well know, the public puts up the money.
Yeah.
The private gets the profit. And if it goes south, the public has to take care of that and suck it up.
Yeah.
So public-private partnerships also make it easy, because if the public aspect is in there and you're doing some sort of a joint co-op with a local government, county, city, municipality, whatever it is, then there are generally less restrictions on a government doing things like easements,
yes,
and purchasing of land, land usage, development costs, things such as that. So it makes it a lot more streamlined, which I think is a bunch of hooey. The mm-hmm. government should have to go through the same thing the private industry does, right, but they don't.
All right, a couple of things. First of all, to clarify for the audience, are you saying that under Dillon rule, as things currently stand in the state of Nevada, with state legislation being what it is, that it is impermissible or extremely difficult to move forward with these very dubious public-private contracts at the local government level, county, municipality, city, something like that?
Yes, they're very narrowly focused that they're allowed to do.
Okay. They have specific purposes,
right,
specific goals. Okay. You know, this sort of resonates with me because you and I know a company that sort of runs as a pyramid scam in Nye County. And they were working a couple years ago to get the town, remember when we had the town of Pahrump?
Yep.
They were working very diligently to get the town to fund a bunch of what they were trying to accomplish.
Exactly.
And you and I know the character of the yo-yo who owns that joint and how that was going to end up.
Yes, and just so you know, this same group of people that are pushing this legislation through were working with the same organization versus the town to try to get this, but they couldn't do it because of the narrow focus on what public-private partnerships are allowed in the state of Nevada.
It didn't meet the standard.
So it didn't meet the standard. If SB 29 passes and gets the governor's signature on it, that can happen. All they've got to do is pay off and woo any local folks, which now would be the county commission, who a number of them are pretty happy with this organization. They've been sucked in and wooed. So
sure,
to put this down, if SB 29 passes, your local governments can literally do whatever they want. The laws that are on the books.
With your money.
With your money, without your permission.
Yes.
So now it takes the state legislature, which meets for 120 days every other year, to have to approve these rules, and it's all statewide. So it's very limited in scope what can be done and opened up. So it limits the government properly.
Now, I want to point out, I brought up that enterprise in Nye County, that because I was personally witness to that, and I know the character of the owner of that organization and how that... The fact that it didn't happen doesn't change in the least. I know exactly how it would have wound up, that the taxpayers of Nye County would have been left holding the bag, and that guy would have all the benefits would have inured to him, and all of the hardship would have inured to the county of Nye and, by association, the taxpayers of Nye County.
Pahrump specifically, yeah.
Yes, yes. So what are you advocating that people do?
Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go online and go to the state legislative website. Just search it. And there is a place where you can go to leave comments on different legislation. And please leave a comment encouraging the members of the Assembly Government Affairs Committee to not pass SB 29 through their committee. And in addition, leave a comment on there for all of the people in the assembly to fight against it. Because home rule opens up the gate to all kinds of intervention, corruption, and overwhelming government. Nanny state will do whatever we want with the tax money that you send to us, and we'll raise your property taxes to pay for it to the limit of the law so that we can do this for the children, for the people, for the area. And what it is you're left holding the bag. The private industry can skate clean. Don't allow, and it's not just public-private partnerships, Dave. It's any law they want to pass at any whim. We've got
to
keep Dillon's rule.
Like a good way to characterize this bill would be it's going to open Pandora's box.
Oh, a huge Pandora's box. We've had trouble with this in various places around the country before, and we continue to have it. The great Judge Forrester Dillon, who it's named after, he's the one that really defined the differences between what is now called Dillon's rule and home rule. And this is a very important thing to defeat in Nevada. I can't understate this. This will change the entire political landscape of the state of Nevada. It will be different rules city by city, county by county, on all kinds of topics and subjects.
Yeah. So go to work. You don't want to be left holding the financial bag. Before we run out of time, can I shift gears a little bit?
Sure.
You mentioned the Nevada legislation only sits for 120 days every other season. What are our odds, do you think, this particular legislative session, constitutional carry for the state of Nevada?
It's dead. It's not going to happen. And here's the thing. Every assembly person, every senator has an option to put in X amount of bills in. Bill draft requests, BDRs it's called. And there's a date by which they all have to have been heard or this, that. Unless at this point in time, it's been about 3 weeks, unless there was a financial exception to it. There's a couple of little things on there. Three different members of the Assembly and Senate collectively put in constitutional carry BDRs. They were all waxed.
Who waxed them? I want to know this. Who waxed good legislation?
The Senate Judiciary Committee Chair, Senator, I think it is Bowman or Bauer, I forget his name, said that it's really not constitutional carry because the Constitution says that they can limit guns. The one that says shall not be infringed, he agrees it can limit.
Well, who cares what the title constitutional carry actually translates to legally?
I'll give you my 2 cents on why it died, Dave.
Okay, go ahead.
Because our governor must have higher political aspirations. He left a lifetime appointment as a federal judge to run as governor. He's in his second term. If he didn't want to go higher, he wouldn't mind signing what would otherwise be considered potentially controversial legislation. So he's got his henchmen in the Senate and the Assembly that he's saying, don't allow these things to get to my desk so I don't look bad. So the other 3.8 million of us in the state are going to suffer for his political aspirations as I see it. Now, and another thing that I got to say, for the last three legislative sessions, they've tried going to constitutional carry. My response is, don't do that. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Right now, it's a felony if you get caught carrying concealed.
Right.
Although it only costs a couple $100 for all of this stuff to get a license.
Right.
So it shouldn't be a felony. It should be a misdemeanor. Start dropping it to a misdemeanor. Then go to an infraction if possible, and then constitutional carry from there. We keep losing it.
Frustrating, especially when our neighbor to the south, Arizona, is one of the states that has it. It's working beautifully.
And to the west in California, it's only misdemeanor.
Yeah. And we'll be back right after these words. And we are back, and it's now time for with people lying in order to try to convince other people to support their political position. Now, some of this I've hinted at in other shows and mentioned briefly, and I'm going someplace with this, something that happened just yesterday, as a matter of fact, at the United States Supreme Court. But when I talk about lying, an example that I've talked about on this show, for instance, is anti-gunners. Every time that laws are passed allowing more people to carry guns or allowing people to carry guns more freely without as much regulatory oversight and so forth, the anti-gunners scream, you know, oh my God, every fender bender is going to be a bloodbath. It's never happened, ever. As various jurisdictions have loosened and the restrictions on carrying personal arms, and more people began to carry personal arms, none of those things that the anti-gunners claim would happen have ever happened. And yet, they continue to tell the lie. If we wanted to make a change here in the state of Nevada, Bill and I were just talking about constitutional carry, the anti-gunners would say the same thing. They would say blood is going to be running in the streets of Nevada if we have constitutional carry. Even though we would, by the end of this year, we'll probably likely have 10 states out of the 50 that are constitutional carry, and the five that exist now, there's no problem. It's a lie. Another one would be, I've mentioned in brief, when the debate was about ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military. All these wild, crazy accusations about how the military was going to be adversely affected. And it was really, these were some crazy lies, just nutty stuff. And, of course, nothing's happened. Everything is just fine. It's going on as it always has. But people want to lie to make their point. And so I'm reading yesterday the oral arguments before the Supreme Court of the United States took place concerning the same-sex marriage case. And this issue is not about your position or my position on same-sex marriage. It's about a lie that Justice Kennedy told. And Justice Kennedy said, as he was going back and forth with some of the attorneys from the different points of view, he said, it's very difficult for this court to say, oh, well, we know better. Very difficult for the Supreme Court to say, we know better? I don't want to say the entire history of the United States Supreme Court is saying we know better, but I'll say a good share of the history of the United States Supreme Court is the court saying we know better. Let me give you a couple examples. For the first 130 years of the United States, the federal government's operation, the rule was money could only come out of the Treasury and be spent by Congress for the enumerated powers, the 17 or 18 enumerated powers that are in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. That was exactly what James Madison, often referred to as the father of the Constitution, that's what he said, that's how the spending clause of the Constitution works. The spending clause is there to authorize Congress to spend money on the enumerated powers. That was in place for the first 130 years of this country's history. Then, in 1922, United States v. Butler, the United States Supreme Court just turned 180 degrees and said, essentially to James Madison, we know better. Exactly what Kennedy is saying. Oh, it's very difficult for us to say that. They said, we know better. And they reversed James Madison. And they said, no. The general welfare, that phrase in the Constitution, as of today, we're going to say that's a separate enumerated power, and that then allowed Congress to spend money on anything, as long as it fit into this gigantic umbrella, this huge tent called general welfare. Then there was a case that came later, Home Building and Loan Association v. Blaisdell. And the United States Constitution says no state shall pass any law that impairs the obligation of contract. Any question about that? No state shall, mandatory language, pass any law that impairs the obligation of contract. Pretty simple stuff. Well, until Minnesota passed a law impairing the obligation of contract. And it went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court made up out of whole cloth this justification, this excuse, why, even though the Constitution says no state shall make any law impairing the obligation of contract, in this case, Minnesota could make a law that was going to be valid impairing the obligation of contract. So again, they said, we know better. And the first time it was, we know better than James Madison, the father of the Constitution. In Blaisdell, it was, we know better than the exact and specific language that every school child can clearly read in the United States Constitution and know what it means. But the United States Supreme Court said, we know better. But Kennedy said, oh, very difficult for us to say we know better. You want to talk about the Supreme Court saying we know better? How about Roe v. Wade? Now, I don't care what side of that issue you are on with Roe. It's very clear, no matter what side of the fence you're on, the Supreme Court definitely took a position and said, we know better. We know better than what? Well, we know better than the states. Now, in addition to that, the Ninth Amendment, I've talked about this often on the Dave Champion Show. The Ninth Amendment tells the United States government, which includes the courts and the United States Supreme Court, that the enumeration of certain rights within the Bill of Rights shall not be construed to disparage or deny other rights retained by the people. Okay? That's our unalienable rights, the hundreds or perhaps even thousands of unalienable rights that are non-enumerated. Okay? The Ninth Amendment is there for a very, very important reason. Do you know in the 226-year history of the United States U.S. Supreme Court, they have only referenced the Ninth Amendment and chosen to declare a right, to take it out of this big thing called the Ninth Amendment, take one little right out and put it on the bulletin board. They've done it one time in 226 years. Clearly, they are saying when it comes to the Ninth Amendment, We know better, even though dozens upon dozens upon dozens of United States Supreme Court cases were ruled incorrectly because the standard that should have been applied was the unalienable right of the citizen who was coming before the court. But the United States Supreme Court said, oh, it's one of the unenumerated, it's one of the non-enumerated. We don't see that. Clearly saying, we know better than the men who wrote the Ninth Amendment and stuck it in there. Now, when we talk about this thing where the court says, you know, well, it's very hard for us to say we know better. What happens when the court says we're not going to do that? For me, the seminal case, the most important case in all of history, where the court said we're not going to play that. We're not going to pursue a social agenda. We're not going to correct the wrong. We're not going to set the wrong right. We're simply going to look at the law and call it what it is and leave it to the politicians to make changes if necessary. Dred Scott v. Sanford, what is now known historically as the infamous Dred Scott case. Well, you know what? I've read Taney's decision. He wrote the majority opinion in Dred. And it is one of the most accurate, factual, truthful, honest decisions the United States Supreme Court has ever rendered. And the difference was, Taney was saying, it's not the court's place to correct a horrible, horrible situation that in fact exists. It is Congress's job to correct this or the state's job to correct this horrible, horrible, terrible situation that exists. But we look at the Constitution as the Supreme Court. We have to look at the Constitution and call it like it is. Well, Taney and the Dred Scott decision have been castigated ever since that day. It is known as the infamous Dred Scott case because he actually followed the reality that the framers built into the Constitution. So, he wrote the famous dissent. Bill, you remember the famous dissent in Olmstead? I'm having a senior moment on his name. But he said the United States government is, I'm not sure I agree with this, he said the United States government is the great teacher of the people. Louis Brandeis, that was the justice's name. He said that...
Of course it was.
Yes. He said that the United States government is the great teacher of the people. Now, I don't necessarily enjoy that characterization. I think we should be in control and the government is not our teacher. But if we give him the benefit and say, okay, the government is the great teacher of the people, Bill, how does it work out when we have justices sit up on the bench of the United States Supreme Court, look out at the people, the cameras, the reporters, and the attorneys, and lie?
Dave, I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago. As a matter of fact, I was there for Barack Obama's re-inauguration.
Okay.
Not that that's why I was
right
there. I just happened to be there at that time on one
well,
of my daughters.
I know you're a big Obama fan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Woohoo. And it said on the side of one of the buildings that the government governs by, they derive their authority by the consent of the governed.
Yes.
So they are restricted by the Constitution and can only pass laws and can only, they can't really change their authority unless the governed agreed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that's supposed to be is we elect representatives through our Republican form of government, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, and then they can do things. Well, there's a whole bunch of crap we have never consented to. So what we now have is based on what you're telling me, and of course they're lying their way through it, what we're hearing about Scalia and Kennedy and the other current justices saying is, look, the consent of the governed is really no longer there. We're telling you how things are.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I want to know where it went wrong. And I have a big idea.
Yeah, I think. You know, my thing is this. I understand that whether it's the attorneys sitting there at the table or whether it's the attorneys, the nine attorneys in the black dresses, I understand that they're attorneys and they make legal arguments, right? Okay. I get it. You know, I look at legal arguments. I read them for a living. I create legal arguments. But lying, blatant BS, that you look at history and you look at what this guy said, they're not even remotely the same. That's not a legal argument. That's BS.
Not only is that not a legal argument, but there should be some penalties for that sort of thing in court. I mean, there should be, you know, like a 2-year suspension, removal of your license, you can't practice law, you can't even be within the industry, something along that lines. You know, it's like if there's a lawsuit, I believe loser pays. If I file a lawsuit against Walmart because I allegedly slipped when in fact it was my own slip and Jimmy slip and fall, and I lose, I got to pay their legal fees and all the court costs I file suit. And we need to have this sort of punishment for attorneys that take on these ridiculous suits and make these lying arguments that totally twist things around so bad. There's got to be some penalty phase to it.
And maybe what Kennedy meant when he said, you know, it's very difficult for us to say, you know, we know better. Maybe what he was saying was, it's very difficult, but we do it all the time. How disingenuous is that?
Absolutely.
And we'll be right back after these words.
And welcome back. Now it's time to crank up what grinds my gears. You know what really grinds my gears? Dirty, underhanded politics. We're going to talk about a couple of bills that are in front of the Nevada State Assembly. It's already passed the Senate, and I'm going to ask you, if you could put that across the bottom there, this is the web address to go to. And then there's a drop-down menu that you can actually select different bills and put in just a sentence or two. Don't give a long diatribe. The shorter, more concise that it is, the more of your assembly people are going to read it. Please go here. It's going to be up this entire segment. We talked at the beginning of the show about no on SB 29 down here. That's the one that would take us from Dillon's rule to home rule, which is a very dangerous and ugly can of worms. We don't want that. And then the other one we're going to talk about now is Senate Bill 485 or SB 485. Essentially, what this bill will do is it will take all of the water rights and all of the authority that the government has when it comes to water, increase it to the government and give near czar-like autonomy to a single individual who would hold the title of the state water engineer. If the state water engineer ends up with full autonomy over your water rights and mine, we are really going to be in a world of hurt. As a matter of fact, the Senate Bill 485 ended up passing the Senate without actually having a committee hearing. There's a couple of sneaky ways that these legislators can go about getting it to a floor vote without having a committee hearing. That happened. And unfortunately, the senator that brought it forth, Pete Goykechi, who happens to be my senator, I'm not happy about this at all. And I know he is a rancher. His whole family are a bunch of ranchers up in Elko, Nevada, up in that county outside of the city of Elko. They have a whole slew of water rights amongst them. And if this bill goes through, 485 happens, the value of their water rights are going to skyrocket. Now, here's one of the problems that you have and I have if we live in a home with a domestic well. It's on our own property. There is no sort of easement to get to it. I own mine. You own yours. This would allow the state water engineer to have authority over your and my individual domestic wells and give essentially a retroactive leeway so that they could actually attach your well. Right now we get 2 acre feet of water in the Pahrump Valley per domestic well per acre. 2 acre feet. That's a lot of water. What they could do and very easily do is what they've talked about doing, reduce that by 3/4, you would have 1/2 acre foot of water rights that you could use. And how would they measure that before giving you severe financial penalties? They'd put a meter on your well without asking, and they would retroactively put in some sort of an easement to get to your well. To that I say, a bunch of hooey, try it. Don't you dare trespass on my land. I might just pull a gun and hold you until the cops get here. There is no way I'm putting up with that. It would essentially give the state water engineer and his disciples full authority on all things water, including those who ranch and use water, grow crops that already have what are called water rights. Essentially, water rights are not rights, they're privileges because they are already manipulated by state legislative mandates and laws that are out there on the books. SB 485, as you can see right down here on the bottom of the screen as I see it, SB 485, that would be far more dangerous and basically give all authority to the one state water engineer who is hired by the governor. They appoint them. You're the state water engineer. You have all this authority as one sole human being. That is not the way this country is founded. It is not the way our state was founded. And it is not the way anybody who knows anything at all about government and rights of individuals would ever want to have this done. We've got to stop SB 29 and not go to home rule. We've got to stop SB 485 giving complete czar-like autonomy, judge, jury, executioner, enforcement, interpretation, everything to one sole state water engineer that could then do whatever they want in each and every valley, all of the aquifers throughout the state. Here in the Pahrump Valley, we have a very, very large aquifer, supposed to be one of the largest aquifers in the lower 48 states, one of the largest, one of the cleanest as well. And we would take away all of the rights and authorities that as individuals that we have, that our local government has over it, that our county commission has over it, and the state water engineer could do whatever they want as soon as these various time deadlines, it's these time sequences, and 2 years, this falls, and the state engineer gets it. Then 2 more years, this falls. After 5, this falls. After a decade, the state water engineer has everything that he wants. We've got to stop Senate Bill 485. 485 is a can of worms as well. If we pass SB 29 and go to home rule, we pass 485 and give czar-like authority and autonomy to the state water engineer. These are Pandora's box, which is going to get us more and more like, say, California, or even more and more like the former Soviet Union. It's really that bad. And keep in mind, we've actually got what are supposed to be conservative, small government Republicans in charge of the state Senate and the state assembly and in the governor's mansion. All of these are supposed to be small government, limited government, lower taxes, more personal liberty type of Republicans. I can tell you, out of all of them that are there, 25 in the assembly, 11 in the Senate, one in the governor's chamber, I can count on one hand, the number of truly conservative, limited government, lower taxes, more personal liberties Republicans we've actually got up there. It's sickening to me. We've got to have your voice. Something along the lines of for SB 29. SB 29 would change from a very controlled Dillon rule to a very uncontrolled home rule form of government in the state of Nevada. Please, by all means, oppose this legislation at all costs. Sincerely, your name and where you live. That'll get them all to read it. When it comes to 485, something along the lines of SB 485 would essentially create full authority and autonomy to one sole individual in the state water engineer and take away all personal and local control of any and all water and water rights within the state. This is incredibly dangerous. It flies in the face of good government. Please, by all means, oppose SB 485, your name and where you live. Dave, I'm going to include you in on this. What do you think about this whole idea of SB 485 coming in and the state water engineer being able to have full, complete, unadulterated authority over all things water in the state of Nevada?
I think it's a prescription for corruption. Now, first of all, whenever you vest one person, even if there's supposed to be some parameters to the job, experience tells us when you invest one person with an inordinate amount of authority over a particular given subject, it opens the door for corruption, because then people start greasing that person's palm, the people with the money and the influence, they get their way. The little guy, and I'm normally not a class warfare guy, but we've sort of devolved in this country to the point where we have the moneyed special interests and we have the average people fighting for what's left over. So while I'm not typically a class warfare guy, I have come more and more to see that where our nation has gone and is going is that paradigm. So I've also noticed that the special interests with the money, and there's been several reports issued over the last few years by researchers that say that America has turned into an oligarchy, and that people with the money, the special interests, get their way no matter what the people want. The polls can show 90% of the people want A, and if the moneyed interest wants B, that's what the politicians do. So I see it as a prescription for corruption. Furthermore, I think water politics is different than every other form of politics, and I'll tell you why. You can talk about gasoline and taxes and regulations. You can talk about zoning laws, business license, all those kind of things, right? You can survive without those. You can't survive without water.
No, you can't. You can't grow a crop without it.
So the politics of water, you can't even live. You buy a house. Here you've got, you know, this is Nevada, so let's call it what it is. A lot of people live in mobile homes, okay? You buy your land, you drill your well, you pop your single wide or your double wide on, and that's where you're going to live your life. That's where you're going to make your life. You might even raise a family there. How's that going to work if through the power of some guy, you can't bring water up out of the ground anymore?
That's right. There's a lot of privately owned pieces and parcels of land in Nevada that are completely worthless because the water rights underneath that ground have been sold off to some other entity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once water rights revert back to the state, they never come back to the people.
I did not know that part.
That is absolutely true. If you revert, surrender, give back, don't use so that they consume back whatever, by whatever means, the state gets those water rights back. Mm-hmm. They are never re-released.
Now, I will admit that I am not steeped in knowledge concerning water rights. I've not made a study of that. I have talked to people, usually those who hold a lot of grandfathered water rights, who talk about the first come, first serve. In other words, I move into the valley, I own 1,500 acres, I'm the first guy here. You can't bring in 20,000 residents and then tell me I can't pump water for my 1,500 acres field anymore. That presumes that the numbers we're getting on the aquifers and whatnot are accurate. I have heard over the years, I don't know if you have, that oftentimes these numbers are cooked. Somebody, oh, we only have this much water. And then you find out, no, well, there's some other studies that they haven't brought out that show there's this much water.
Yeah, the studies are at odds. And the thing is, there's a plan in act to actually measure the aquifer. And there's the guys that are out there that are willing to actually measure our Pahrump aquifer so we know just what it is. You measure it a few times over the next couple of decades, you know exactly the way it works, the ebb and flow of the aquifer, if you will. But here,
and I would say we need it measured by different companies each time, not the same company getting their palm greased by the same guys.
Well, right. And this is right now volunteers that are willing to go out and do this.
Good.
So even better, better, volunteer. The thing you were talking about, you could grease the palms of the guys. What's happened in recent years is instead of greasing the palm of the guy that's got the job, the people with the money tell the person who appoints, this is the person to put in there. We paid you, we want you in there.
That's the corruption
you know, I'm talking about. You know,
right?
Who's running the FDA? The guys that used to run Monsanto.
Absolutely.
And work for Monsanto. The guys that are in charge of farming regulations, same sort of thing. These are the people that used to work for the big organizations the government's supposed to hold back. Yeah. They're now running the whole friggin' deal.
It's called regulatory capture. That's the phrase for it.
So if that's what you want with your water, that's what you're going to get. You've got to oppose SB 29 and SB 45. Please go here. We're going to leave this up just coming up to the break, and we'll see you for segment 4.
All right, we are back, and we are in segment number 4, where we talk about the things that interest you and, of course, interest Bill and I as well. Somebody sent us a very nice email talking about Jeff Cooper and Weaver and referenced by or incorporated by reference to Southwest Pistol League that used to take place in Canyon Country, California back in the 70s.
Yep.
And so Bill and I decided to use that very nice email the gentleman sent us and sort of launch into a discussion about the evolution of the 1911, not going back to, you know, the early 1900s.
Not John Browning's 1911 version, but we're talking more
the 70s forward.
Modern gunfighting.
Right. And sort of the evolution, how that came around, talking about Bill Weaver and the Weaver stance, and then we're going to have that very ugly discussion about Weaver versus ISO. Bill, lead off on the evolution of the modern 1911.
Yeah, well, you have the Southwest Pistol League, which had a few guys. Probably the most noted names were Jeff Cooper and Jack Weaver.
I've got to tell you, one of my dearest friends, who is one of the finest 1911 gunsmiths I know, still lives in Canyon Country to this day. That's where Southwestern Pistol League started, was in Canyon Country, which was middle of nowhere back then. Mm-hmm. Now it's fully the suburbs.
Industry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he was the one on SEAL Team 1 back in Vietnam with the very first SEAL team. He then did 34 years on LAPD, I think. He's retired now. His name is Jerry Fritz. And he used to shoot with Bill Weaver and Cooper out at Southwestern Pistol League. Yeah, yeah. One of my dearest friends.
So it's interesting. The Weaver stance came about, of course, because of Jack Weaver. And he was an L.A. County Sheriff's Deputy.
I said Bill, didn't I?
Yeah.
Good. Thank you for correcting me.
Jack. He was an L.A. County Deputy Sheriff. And one of the competitions they had for Southwest Pistol League was they put up a balloon at 7 yards. And from the holster, whatever technique you want, whoever can go on the timer from the holster to shooting the balloon and it pops wins. Mm-hmm. It's one of their competitions. Well, you know, most of these guys are bringing up and it's the old FBI stance, you know, kind of crouched out, one hand out there, take a shot. Well, Jack Weaver decided, I've got this other hand, why not use it? So he would pull the gun out kind of quick, bring the other hand up, drop his head down to meet the sights, and take a press. So that was the original Weaver stance. And it was about a 45-degree angle. Now, keep in mind, about 5 or 6 months before Jack Weaver passed away, I ambushed him at his house and sat there, and we chatted with a couple of the people who were with me for about an hour and a half. What an amazing, neat guy. And especially his wife opens a door to a bunch of strangers. Hi, you know, is the man here? We couldn't find your phone number through any of our contacts. We're a professional firearm instructor. Can we sit down and meet the man? Absolutely. Very, very gracious. What a neat couple. Yeah. Just neat, really, really neat people. So, you know, it was interesting that, the original Weaver stance has been modified into what they call the modern Weaver that has a whole lot more dynamics to it.
Now, let me interrupt you for a quick story. Have you ever heard of Kent Turnipseed?
No. Nope.
Okay. Out of Southern California, up near the Santa Barbara area, super martial artist, firearms instructor. Years ago, probably 20, 25 years ago, I took a Weaver, an 8-hour class on just the Weaver. Not the modified Weaver we all know today, the old
original Weaver. There's not 8 hours involved.
Because he's such a purist, okay, and he talked about the skeletal alignment and all. 8 hours working on the Weaver stance, I was sore for days.
I'll tell you, he's wrong, because Jack Weaver told me personally that there is no science behind the Weaver stance. It's merely your 45-degree interview stance as a cop, 45 degrees off. Right. If you need to shoot and your feet aren't moving, how do you best do it? Drop whatever might be in your hands, grab your gun, bring them together. You know, as the sights come up, the head comes down, and you shoot. Yep. Now, we have learned that there's ways to modify that into the modified Weaver, modern Weaver, some call it, into something that works more effectively with more recoil control such as that. But this is one shot on a balloon at 7 yards.
Yep. So it was for speed.
Yeah, it was. All about speed. Yep. So first shot hit, good to go. You don't have to worry about follow-ups. So whatever this guy taught for 8 hours, I guarantee you he read far more into it than Jack Weaver ever did.
That's Kent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So anyhow, Southwest Pistol League, and of course, Jeff Cooper and the other guys are like, wow, there's something to this. Modern Weaver was in the Weaver stance, and all the fighting that went around it was put together.
And I think it's fair to say Cooper really took Jack's stance and brought it into the mainstream of pistol
shooting. The American Pistol Institute, later Gunsight Academy.
Yep.
And it still operates today under the original Cooper method. His wife, his widow, still lives out there in the cons.
Okay, now, I don't think we want to detail all of the progression of the 1911 from the fighting tool that it was in the 70s to the fighting tool that it is today. Suffice to say, a lot of improvements have been made.
Sure.
The high-end 1911s, there's a reputation that 1911s are not reliable. The high-end 1911s are as reliable as anything out there, period. Yes, I own them. I've shot the ever-living bejesus out of them. Okay, I'm a 1911 guy through and through.
Now, and with me, I got to tell you, I am a recovering Glockaholic. I still own five or six Glocks.
Sure.
And I own a couple of 1911s, one of them custom built. And I got to tell you, there's advantages and disadvantages to each. And I can see why some might go one way, some might go the other way. So I understand. I am not diehard. I'll fight tooth and nail for one or the other. I'm really neutral. Yeah. It's a tool.
It's a preference.
Yeah, I like Stanley hammers. Doesn't mean I won't pick one up that Craftsman made and use it.
All right, so let's get into the ugly part of this. The Weaver versus Isosceles.
Yeah, I think it's a wasted argument.
Yes and no, and let me describe why. Certainly, I've worked with a lot of ISO shooters. Okay. And when I'm working with an ISO shooter and they're committed, they're married to ISO, I teach them and I work with them and I improve their skill sets within the confines that they have chosen ISO, and that's the way that's going to be. There are some issues, though, in the tactical world. Not out on the range, okay? Out on the range, whether you come up like this or whether you come up like this, it doesn't matter. One of the things that when people have been open to hearing why I prefer the Weaver in a tactical setting, one of the things I'll do is I'll use something as a wall, and I'll point out by switching your grip and staying in the Weaver position, you can show just the muzzle of the gun, perhaps a little bit of your arm, and you're just seeing a portion of the face, very small segment where your eye is on top of the sight. And I point out that in ISO, that is not possible. In ISO, since the gun is more or less centered in the body, when you come out, whether you step out, whether you lean out, you, in a tactical setting, you have to expose more of your body, or you have to then learn and be an expert, if you want to live through the fight, at both ISO and Weaver, because standing in the middle of a parking lot, it might be ISO, but then when there's suddenly something to get behind, now you're back in Weaver, which I think is problematic all around. So that's my view on why I prefer Weaver tactically.
All valid arguments.
Okay.
All of them. Totally valid arguments. And just so you know, I tend to shoot Weaver. I taught over 10,000 students in my career how to shoot Weaver. Okay. But I also like the modern isosceles, and I'll shoot that often. Now, the modern isosceles has been around for about 10 or 12 years. It happened after 9/11, after the door kickers started going into Afghanistan and Iraq. We won't get into the politics of that.
No.
And what they did was you had some of the very best tacticians, door kickers that the world has ever seen, decided they wanted to be even better. So they brought in some of the best competition, best and fastest, most accurate competition shooters in the world, brought them in. They showed the door kickers their techniques. So the modern system has now evolved into the very best tacticians and the very best that had to do with competition into a conjoined, this is now how it's working out.
But it's a very specific application. For instance, door kicking, which you mentioned, okay? When you come through the door and you're in ISO, the concept was from day one of using ISO and door kicking is you're presenting your body armor.
Another superfluous argument
to your
advice.
I'm just saying, that was the original argument.
The original argument, for sure.
Okay. The average guy walking through the Walmart parking lot when some guy, you know, comes out with a machete, okay, he's not dealing with people with firearms. He's not wearing body armor at all. So that original argument was very narrow.
I agree. And this is where I think all of it falls apart.
All right.
When you are in a live fire engagement, you've been shot at, I've been shot at. When you're in a live fire dangerous situation, mm-hmm. you're not going to be standing there with your feet planted in a stance returning fire. If you are, you have no idea what you're doing.
Right.
You know, that's where to start. Get some fundamentals. But really what matters, mm-hmm. sight alignment, sight picture, and trigger control. You can be upside down on a handstand with one hand, shooting with the other one. If you've got those three basic ingredients, none of the rest of it matters. Really what the stance gets down to is follow-up shots and can you move from it. You should be behind some sort of cover or at least concealment. Keep in mind, in most of today's society, there's very little bulletproof cover. There's mostly
especially from rifle
concealment
fire.
Where rounds will go through. I mean, fire hydrant's pretty good cover, but it's awful small. You're not going to hide behind
not.
Well, nor am I. But just keep in mind that the arguments here are superfluous range stuff or going into competition.
I will say this. On the street, when I've done this for real, I've never been in a situation, because I am the first guy, you know, people imagine guys like me have much bravado. No, I'm being shot at. I am getting the hell out of the way.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I've never been in a situation, because the first place I go is to cover concealment. Okay, I'm not even worried about shooting the guy. I want to be behind cover and concealment.
Yep.
I'll shoot
first
him later,
thing,
right?
Priority one.
Right. I've never been in a situation on the street for real where I would, had I even trained with ISO, where I would have been able to employ that except door kicking.
Okay. Now keep this in mind. Regardless of how you're trained, you'll adapt based on your surroundings to be able to shoot. And if you have sight alignment, sight picture, and trigger control, chances of hitting your target are way up there. So I don't really care what stance. And an interesting thing, Ray Chapman actually bid almost a 50-50 conversion between the Weaver and the isosceles, and they call it the Chapman stance. Out at Gunsight in Arizona, I still go there occasionally. There, when I originally went there in 94, they taught the true modern Weaver. Now they're literally teaching the Chapman stance, but calling it the modern Weaver. And it's not the modern Weaver, it's the Chapman stance. So do one of two things, Gunsight. Either call it the Chapman stance what it is, or teach what the modern Weaver really is. And Ray Chapman, he actually was one of the senior staff members at Gunsight for years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was.
Okay. All right, so the bottom line is, and I agree with you on this, that when you have to adapt to your circumstances, sight alignment, sight picture, trigger control, that is what saves the day, not stance.
The rest of it, I don't care what you use on the range. If you practice it hard enough and you do a good enough job, it's going to work.
We'll see you next week. Thanks for being here.